This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. Drug makers Pfizer and BioNTech say they've won permission for emergency use of their COVID-19 vaccine in Britain, the world's first coronavirus shot that's backed by rigorous science. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The green light allows Britain to become one of the first countries to begin vaccinating its population as it tries to curb Europe's deadliest outbreak. The Department of Health and Social Care says in a statement, the vaccine will be made available across Britain from next week. Other countries aren't far behind, though. Regulators in the US and the EU are also vetting the Pfizer shot, along with a similar vaccine made by competitor Moderna. British regulators also are considering another shot made by AstraZeneca and Oxford University. Charles de Ledesma, London.
The European Union criticized Britain's rapid approval of the Pfizer and BioNTech's COVID-19 vaccine on Wednesday, saying its own procedure was more thorough after Britain became the first Western country to endorse a COVID-19 shot. The decision was made under an ultra-fast emergency approval process, which allowed the British drugs regulator to temporarily authorize the vaccine only 10 days after it began examining data from large-scale trials. U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar says Britain's initial approval of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine should give Americans confidence as the drug maker next week moves further toward seeking U.S. approval. Azar told Fox Business News, for the American people, this should be very reassuring, adding we're going to let the FDA run through its process. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says U.S. President Donald Trump will sign coronavirus relief legislation proposed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. But U.S. Senate Democrat leader Chuck Schumer rejected the latest Republican coronavirus aid plan. This is VOA News. Delegates of warring sides in Afghanistan announced Wednesday they had agreed on a framework for their peace negotiations aimed at ending the country's protracted conflict. Reuters' Emer McCarthy has more.
After 19 years of war, representatives from both the Afghan government and the Taliban say they've reached a breakthrough agreement, a preliminary deal to press on with peace talks. It's the first written agreement between the two sides in the conflict and is a big step towards moving on to more substantive issues, such as negotiations for a possible ceasefire, and has been welcomed by the United Nations and Washington. U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation Zalmay Khalilzad said that the two sides had agreed on a three-page agreement codifying rules and procedures for their negotiations on a political roadmap and a comprehensive ceasefire.
That's Reuters' Eamon McCarthy reporting. Leading Hong Kong dissident Joshua Wong was jailed alongside two other activists Wednesday for taking part in last year's huge democracy protests as the crackdown on Beijing's critics gathers pace. Wong was prosecuted alongside close friends and fellow campaigners Ivan Lam and Agnes Chow over a rally outside the police headquarters. The trio, some of the city's most visible and vocal critics of Beijing's rule, pleaded guilty to citing an unlawful assembly and other charges. President-elect Joe Biden says China should not expect fast relief from President Trump's tariffs once he takes office. AP's Sagar Magani has more.
Biden says he will not immediately lift the tariffs the Trump administration put on many Chinese imports, nor break the president's initial trade deal. He tells New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman the key to talks with China is leverage, adding, we don't have it yet. Washington and Beijing have been in a year-long trade war, and while some industries have benefited, most experts have blasted the Trump policies, saying American businesses and consumers have borne most of the tariff costs. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The U.S. Justice Department is investigating whether there was a secret scheme to lobby White House officials for a pardon. AP's Mike Hempin reports.
A court order unsealed Tuesday reveals individuals suspected of having acted to secretly lobby White House officials to secure a pardon or sentence commutation. In a related scheme, it also reveals a substantial political contribution was floated in exchange for a pardon or reprieve of sentence. A Justice Department official speaking on condition of anonymity says no government official is the target of the investigation. In a Tuesday night tweet, President Trump said, quote, pardon investigation is fake news.
From Washington, via remote, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's Bobi Wine tells the Election Commission to stop police interference in his presidential campaign.
We wanted to tell the Electoral Commission that the police and the military are trying to kill us. We have tasked them to take charge or resign. We have asked them to ask the police to stop blocking the roads for us.
Kenya's deputy president weighs in on BBI referendum. The ILO says COVID-19 is driving wages down and increasing inequality. And UN and Nigerian authorities say more bodies have been recovered after Boko Haram massacre.
We believe that one of the reasons why the crimes have continued is because of lack of accountability. Impunity always leads to further commission of crimes by perpetrators.
Today is the International Day of Persons with Disabilities, and what's causing the death at sea of small-scale fishermen off the coast of Senegal? Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan presidential candidate Bobi Wine has accused the security forces of trying to stop his campaign. Wine filed a complaint with Uganda's Election Commission after police fired tear gas and rubber bullets on Tuesday at his supporters, sending at least five people to the hospital. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
In a three-hour closed-door meeting Wednesday with the Electoral Commission, Robert Chagulanyi, better known as singer-turned-politician Bobi Wine, says he had to briefly halt his campaign because of attacks on him and his supporters by police. The meeting was held under heavy security with police and military personnel surrounding the Electoral Commission offices. Wine says he came to the Electoral Commission because it has been silent ever since police arrested him last month, just after he entered the presidential race. Speaking to the media after the meeting, Wine shared photos of what he said were police and soldiers brutalizing his supporters.
These are the people that are being shot dead by the police and the military, and some goons that move around with guns, but in plain clothes. These are the scenes of our campaign meetings, marred with violence, tear gas and live bullets.
Wine said he made several requests to the Electoral Commission.
We wanted to tell the Electoral Commission that the police and the military are trying to kill us. We have tasked them to take charge or resign. We've asked them to prevail over the police and the military, to tell them to keep out of this election, especially the military. We have asked them to ask the police to stop blocking the roads for us.
Authorities have accused Wine and his party of violating COVID-19 restrictions with large gatherings. Electoral Commission Chairman Simon Byabakama said Wednesday that every candidate must commit themselves to complying and abiding by the measures put in place by the commission to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Regarding the violence, Byabakama had this to say.
We have also committed to ensuring that the heightened environment is mitigated. And one of those ways is for both parties to take responsibility. Therefore, I do not see why security would have to come in with a strong hand in order to enforce these guidelines when the people are compliant.
Wine is scheduled to resume his campaign Thursday in eastern Uganda. He is one of 10 candidates challenging longtime President Yoweri Museveni in the January 14th election. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto and his allies say they will support the constitutional reform process known as the BBI. However, Ruto told a news conference on Wednesday that he and his supporters want the referendum to take place alongside the 2022 general election. Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
Deputy President Ruto and his allies of 146 members of parliament and seven governors told a news conference Wednesday that the BBI referendum should take place during the 2022 election as a separate ballot question.
Our proposal is we should commit every resource that is available towards tackling the corona pandemics, alleviating the serious crisis in our economy, and that there is a possibility for us to take this referendum together with the election in 2020. We want to be persuaded why it's not possible for us to do it in 2022. Our proposal is we can do it together with the election in 2022.
Member of Parliament Aden Duale questioned the legitimacy of spending billions of shillings on a referendum only 1 year ahead of an election that is expected to cost Kenya taxpayers millions of US dollars. Instead, Duale suggested that the funds set aside for the referendum should go towards addressing the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic.
We are in the midst of a deadly pandemic that has ravaged our country. Given the foregoing, it is legitimate to question the wisdom of spending 14 billion shillings a year before an election that will cost us another 42 billion going by the 2017 figures, when a referendum could be conducted as the seventh ballot in a general election at a virtually no cost.
The BBI report calls for an increase in the number of members of parliament by over 200 members, from 416 seats to 640. Deputy President Ruto says the high number of members of parliament will impose an unsustainable burden on taxpayers. He says his proposal will lower the number by 60 members to save cost.
Without reducing the current members of parliament from 600. And I have told you the proposal we are putting on the table in whatever form will bring down that number from the number that is being proposed under the BBI arrangement. A minimum of 60 MPs will be slashed out by adopting the proposal we have made, even if we nominate the rest of the women to fill the two-thirds gender rule. So our proposal from the start will cut down the number of MPs that is being proposed currently.
Deputy President William Ruto said there was still time to build consensus for a win-win referendum. He said the referendum should be structured in a way that will enable Kenyans to vote for specific articles independently instead of the whole document.
It is practically possible for us to give an opportunity for Kenyans to vote yes for resources going to the county and to vote no for what it or she doesn't want. And that is the opportunity we are saying should be made available to Kenyans. The opportunity to allow Kenyans to vote on issues will completely remove this us versus them no yes referendum contest. Okay, for us to vote no yes in the last referendum because we were enacting a new constitution. So the vote was between the current and the old. Now we are not voting for the whole constitution. We are voting for articles of the constitution.
Wednesday's consultative meeting of Deputy President Ruto and his allies came a week after President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga launched the signature collection drive. The BBI principals say there's no more room to accommodate new amendments because the secretariat has already collected enough signatures for the referendum. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Nigerian authorities say they are trying to rescue at least 10 women who were abducted by Boko Haram militants in an attack over the weekend that left at least 43 people dead. Boko Haram on Tuesday said its fighters killed 78 farmers in the attack, which was condemned by the United Nations and rights groups who are calling for the women to be released. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian security forces and local militia groups in Borno State are searching to find people still missing from the attack which happened Saturday in the village of Zabumeri. The UN's Nigeria country director, Edward Callum, visited the Zabumeri community on Tuesday and met with families of the victims. Although 43 people were initially reported killed in the attack, the UN says more bodies have been recovered by the search team. Eve Sabak is the head of public information at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
When such traumatic attacks happen, civilians run and flee in all directions possible. And this is also why it's very difficult for us to confirm numbers of people who died during the incidents, but also number of people missing and what really happened to them.
Rights group Amnesty International said 10 women are among those still missing. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said the killing was barbaric and promised more financing will be provided for security agencies to tackle terrorists. Amnesty International says attacks on civilians have continued because no one is being held responsible. Sheung Bakari is an Amnesty spokesperson.
We believe that one of the reasons why the crimes have continued is because of lack of accountability. Impunity always leads to further commission of crimes by perpetrators.
A mass burial was held for the victims on Sunday morning. Since the attack, the farmers and citizens reeling from the incident have not returned to harvest their farms. Sabak says the consequences will be severe.
We are recording a very high number of people being food insecure, and we're extremely worried that next year during the lean season we'll have more than 5 million people facing hunger. So this is why the attack this weekend is absolutely outrageous.
This week, controversial Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau released a video claiming responsibility for the attack and said the group killed 78 farmers, not 43. Shekau, speaking in a local language, said the attack was retaliation for his men who were captured by farmers and handed to the military. Timothy Yobiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 3rd. The International Labour Organization says wages plunged during the first 6 months of the year due to COVID-19 pandemic, with women and lower-paid workers among the biggest losers. The report is based on data from 30 major economies in Africa, the Americas, Asia, and Europe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A survey of 28 European countries finds that without wage subsidies, women would have lost 8.1% of their wages in the second quarter of this year, compared to 5.4% for men. The data indicates 50% of those in lower-skilled jobs would have lost more than 17% of their wages without subsidies. The International Labour Organization says the unequal impact of the pandemic on wage earners in wealthy societies is relevant to developing countries where workers in the formal sectors have been particularly hard hit. Despite the bleak picture, ILO Director General Guy Ryder says there's some positive news.
We estimate that the wage subsidies which have been introduced in many countries have compensated for 40% of the total wage bill loss. And because wage subsidies are more likely to benefit low-paid workers, it is also likely that these policies have helped to mitigate the upward trend in inequality.
ILO economists warn the COVID-19 crisis is likely to greatly increase poverty and inequality. World Bank figures indicate the number of people falling into extreme poverty because of the pandemic could be between 88 and 115 million. Ryder notes 90% of the ILO's 187 member states have some form of minimum wage. That, he says, can serve to lessen the impact of the pandemic on workers.
Next, our report suggests that adequate minimum wages have significant potential to reduce both inequality and poverty. Our studies show that they could reduce household income inequality by as much as 10% at the national level. In addition, minimum wages can also play an important role in creating a recovery that is human-centered.
ILO Chief Ryder notes the pandemic has rendered an unprecedented blow to the world at work. He says he expects the aftermath will be long-lasting, turbulent, and full of uncertainty. He says government subsidies and interventions will be reduced over time, putting downward pressure on wages. He says there must be an appropriate and balanced approach to wages in the recovery process to stop a resurgence of poverty and prevent a further widening of existing inequality. And last but not least, to keep the economy moving. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today, December 3rd, is the International Day of Persons with Disabilities. The World Health Organization estimates that 1 billion people, about 15% of the world's population, experiences some form of disability, and that disability prevalence is higher in developing countries. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the USA.
As the world celebrates people living with disability today, the 2020 theme is Not All Disabilities Are Visible. It also focuses on spreading awareness and understanding of disabilities that are not immediately apparent, such as mental illness, chronic pain, among others. According to the World Health Organization, World Report on Disability estimates that 450 million people are living with mental or neurological condition, and two-thirds of these people will not seek professional medical help due to stigma and neglect. Baria Hassan is a mother of 10-year-old daughter battling cerebral palsy in Kenya. She says the discrimination from the society has been the biggest challenge for her, and that most caregivers do not want to take care of special kids.
When I realized that my daughter has cerebral palsy, actually it took me a lot, like 3 years, to accept that my daughter has cerebral palsy. We face a lot of challenges, like a curse. You cannot leave anybody with your child. The second challenge we face is about the medicine. Sometimes you don't go to work and you don't have the money to buy the medicine. The father running away from home, family members see you like you have a curse in the family, a burden.
While 1 in 160 children are identified as on the autism spectrum, the deaf children have become more vulnerable to abuse in Kenya. Dorcas Wallace, Chief Executive Officer, Binti Africa, transformational organization of people living with disability, said that most of the deaf children are facing social isolation and sexual abuse, especially during this period of COVID-19 pandemic.
Challenges these children face is they are not able to communicate. They also have that social isolation. During this pandemic, we've been having the deaf children in particular becoming more vulnerable to abuse. They are neglected, and again, they are sexually assaulted than their hearing peers.
Doka says in Africa, and especially in Kenya, most of the disabled children are not taken care of, and some do not even access basic education.
In Kenya particularly, most of the disabled children, they are not able to go to school because even some parents don't see the need of taking these children to school. We are seeing a number of disabled children on the streets being used by their guardians and even their parents. They are being used like income-generating activities.
On the other hand, David Olesankok, a nominated Member of Parliament in Kenya to represent people living with disability, said that Kenya has made strides in ensuring the rights of the people living with disability are not violated.
In the African setup, a child born with disability is considered a curse. And in some communities like where I come from, the birth attendants are given specific instruction to kill them at birth. Therefore, we have really come from far. And I can attest, in Kenya, persons with disability don't pay for taxes. Pay as you earn taxes should be left for persons with disability because they have an extra expense.
According to WHO, during the COVID-19 pandemic, isolation, disconnect, disruption routines and diminished services have greatly impacted the lives and mental well-being of people with disabilities around the world. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Migrant numbers surged in October and November off the coast of Senegal as more than 500 people died in shipwrecks, according to the NGO Alam Fon, which helps with rescue at sea. The group says many of them were small-scale fishermen trying to leave Senegal for the Canary Islands. They say it is difficult in sustaining themselves because fishing stocks have depleted due to overfishing by industrial boats. Dr. Ibrahim Asise, the campaign manager in Senegal for Greenpeace, says the government's lack of transparency and international complicity is leading to the unsustainable situation.
From 2012 to now, the number of industrial fishing vessels has duplicated from 100 and something. We are now around 200. And officially, Senegal don't have agreement with foreign countries. So how happened that this means that all vessels that were granted new license are Senegalese, or are Senegalese vessels? So how Senegalese government managed to have such a big number of vessels joining the national fleet in the context of IU fishing when you have the stock is already depleted? So these are the questions that make us request from the government to publish the list of the vessels fishing in Senegal.
Artisanal fishermen, activists here in Senegal say part of the problem is that there hasn't been a survey done to actually measure what the status is of the Senegalese fishing stocks. Is that correct?
Normally, Senegalese government should evaluate the stock each year because it's only based on the knowledge of the availability of the stock that the government can manage better the resource. The last evaluation was done by FAO and COPAL, so the information are here, but the monitoring and the evaluation of stock should not rely on international organizations. It should be a task from the government. And if you follow last evaluation, valuation of stock, particularly for small pelagics, very clear that the stock now at the limit of exploitation. The authority find a way to say that because they are not targeting the same species, but we have a trophic chain that they are all linked with each other. So you cannot target one species without having consequences in other species.
The surge in migrants and taking the boats off of the west coast of Senegal to the Canary Islands in September and October, the tragic shipwrecks and deaths that happened along with it. A lot of sources say that it was a high percentage of fishermen on those boats. Does Greenpeace see a link between depleting fishing stocks and economic desperation among the fishermen and the women who process the fish as well?
People are desperate, and if the situation didn't change, the same activity will continue because they don't have choice. They just don't have any hope that it will change. For me, there is a global system that is really undermining the economy and the livelihood of people for a country like West African country. And this global system, the big players, of course, the Senegalese government have a big responsibility, but the countries, the institutions have also big responsibility. Because if in one side they say they are supporting country in their budget, technically, financially, to build a project, to be resilient, to face the COVID or food insecurity, etc. In the same time, they are promoting a relation that allowed bilateral agreement that allowed their same country to come and to take the fish from the poor country.
That was Dr. Ibrahim Asise, campaign manager in Senegal for Greenpeace. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. And that's it for this Thursday, December 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sikus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.